Good day. Today's Thursday, 30th October 2025, and let me remind you again before we proceed with the video to tick the like button if once you've listened or watched the video, you've liked what you've seen and heard, be that whether you watch the entire video or only part of it. Well, let's proceed now to discuss the news of the last 24 hours, and we've had some important developments, very important developments in the relationship between China and the United States, important developments in terms of the relationships, the long-term relationships between Russia and the United States, and increasingly dramatic and some would say ominous news from the battlefields of Ukraine. Let me begin first with the meeting between the Chinese President Xi Jinping and the American President Donald Trump, which took place in South Korea, where these two leaders have been meeting and where they had a discussion that seems to have focused exclusively, so far as I can see, on trade issues. Now, here perhaps it's worth going back and looking at what has been happening in US-China relations since President Trump became president back in January for a second term. Of course, over the course of previous presidencies, Obama's, Trump's first term, Joe Biden's term, relations between China and the United States have been slowly and then more quickly deteriorating. There's been a general consensus developing in the United States that China, far from being an economic partner, has become a major geopolitical rival. I personally strongly dispute the second assertion. There's also been a developing consensus within the United States that the economic rise of China is somehow a threat to the United States and must be stopped or, and if possible, reversed. And the Chinese technological development is in particular a source of profound concern. And, well, there's been tensions over Taiwan. There have been tensions about the Chinese trade surplus with the United States also. And under President Trump, during his first term, the United States started to take measures to restrict imports from China. Measures, by the way, which overall were unsuccessful. President Biden didn't pursue economic war against China in the same way, but he worked very hard to prevent exports of high technology goods to China, and he did everything he possibly could to try to slow down Chinese technological and scientific development. I think it is now universally acknowledged, without any success here at all. And, well, President Trump, when he became president, bought into all of these ideas and theories, as far as I can see, and policies, and sought to continue them and, in some respects, escalate them. So over the course of the last 9 months, there have been more attempts by the United States to thwart scientific and technological developments in China. And there's also been constant pressure on China, geopolitical pressure on China. The United States has been conducting a build-up in the Asia-Pacific region. It's been hardening alliances with countries like Japan and the Philippines against China. There's been a steady cranking up of rhetoric against China. And, of course, in April, the Trump administration began by imposing heavy tariffs against China. Now, these tariffs were promoted originally by the administration itself as being a protectionist measure in order to support the American economy and foster reindustrialization in the United States. As has become increasingly clear since April, the United States, the President of the United States, has come to see tariffs also as a coercive geopolitical tool that he can use in order to extract concessions from countries that are threatened by the United States with tariffs, in order to extract from those countries concessions on various political, international and other geopolitical issues. Indeed, the president has recently taken to making really quite extraordinary claims that it is because of his threats of tariffs that various countries have agreed to peace agreements with each other. Claims, by the way, which I consider to be entirely untrue. Just saying. Anyway, all of this led, as I said, to an economic war between China and the United States. Both increased tariffs to stellar levels. The United States also discovered that China was restricting exports to the United States of rare earths. There were also various other subcomponents which were no longer being exported by China to the United States, and these were causing problems within the United States for US industries. The high tariffs that China imposed on US agricultural exports to China began to affect sections of the farming industry, soybean producers most specifically, and complaints started to grow that the shops would run out of goods, finished goods, in the United States before very long. There were rumors that there were warnings of that kind from companies like Walmart. The lack of rare earths was starting to impact on important high technology sectors of the US economy, including perhaps especially the defense industries. There was also talk that subcomponents, restrictions by China of exports of subcomponents, were also starting to affect the US auto industry as well. And anyway, there was then an agreement between China and the United States that the tariffs would be reduced significantly. In fact, the higher tariffs were brought down very far. And it's clear that the first step to do that was taken by the United States, and a series of meetings took place in Geneva and Madrid between Chinese and American trade negotiators, the Americans led mostly by the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. And in summary, in Madrid, a pause was agreed on retaliatory measures between China and the United States. And the Chinese, undoubtedly, and I say this, I read their media every day, so I can say this definitely, the Chinese were expecting that after the truce that was agreed in Madrid, a 6-week stop, as I remember, on tariffs, formal trade negotiations between China and the United States would begin in order to sort out all the various issues and perhaps arrive at a trade agreement. Except that never happened. Instead, the United States showed no interest in beginning those kind of negotiations. In August, even before the truce in Madrid was negotiated, the United States took an astonishing step, which is to try to impose port fees on ships of Chinese construction that docked in American ports. Many of these ships, of course, not owned by Chinese shipping companies, but simply built in China. This provoked a very angry reaction from China, and according to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, led to a stormy meeting between himself and one of China's trade negotiators, Li Changgang, and, well, other steps, similar steps, increasingly began to be taken by the United States, including further pressure on China, for example, banning Chinese airlines from coming to the United States across Russian airspace, which severely impacts Chinese airlines flying to the east coast of the United States, and, well, various other measures of that kind. And China eventually responded and announced that it was setting up a regulatory framework connected to exports of rare earths, a regulatory framework modelled on the kind of regulatory framework that the United States also has in terms of technology exports, and which it has had since the 1950s. I've seen it suggested that 1959 is the actual formal starting point for this sort of thing. And anyway, the Chinese reproduced it, and that provoked a furious reaction in the United States, a very panicky reaction on the part of the United States. President Trump threatened China with 100% tariffs. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said that China was failing and falling and was trying to drag everybody else down with it. Anyway, there was a furious reaction from the United States when that happened. But then, eventually, wiser heads, or cooler heads, prevailed. And it was pointed out, no doubt, to the president himself and to other US officials that reigniting the economic war with China that took place in the spring was a very bad idea. It would invite further retaliatory measures from China. And as the events of the spring and early summer showed, China is in a better position to navigate that kind of economic war, a much stronger position than the United States is. So the president then started to speak much more politely about the Chinese leader, President Xi Jinping, and there have been discussions, meetings between US and Chinese trade officials in Kuala Lumpur to try to find some way forward towards a compromise. And all of this provided the background to this visit by President Trump to the APEC summit in South Korea and to various statements that the US president has been making, that he expected to meet there with President Xi Jinping of China. So I have described all of this. I've gone into some detail to explain all of this, because without understanding this past history, it is impossible to understand what happened yesterday and the day before yesterday over the course of the various meetings that have been taking place in South Korea. Briefly, and in summary, the United States has dialed back all of the salami slicing measures that it took, which so angered the Chinese, bringing the United States and China basically back to where they were at the time of the truce agreement in Madrid in September, though the harbour fees, which the United States imposed on China, and which are also apparently being walked back, were actually imposed in August. And in addition, the United States has had to go a step beyond that, because over the course of the economic war that took place between China and the United States over the course of this year. The President of the United States imposed 20% tariffs, additional 20% tariffs on Chinese goods exported to the United States, claiming that he was doing so on the grounds that China was in some form or way responsible for imports into the United States of fentanyl, which is a major social issue in the United States. And, well, the president, the United States, has walked back some of these sanctions, in effect reducing those sanctions, halving those sanctions from 20% to 10% tariffs, halving those tariffs from 20% to 10%, which is a significant, though not dramatic, reduction. So this is what came out of this meeting, of these series of meetings that have taken place in Kuala Lumpur and now in South Korea. A significant walk back by the United States. Now, the Chinese Commerce Ministry, an immensely powerful ministry in China, just saying, has now issued its own statements and explanations as to what has happened. The Americans have been claiming that China has agreed to delay introduction of the regulatory framework on rare earths for a year. As I discussed in a recent program, that was something that Scott Bessent claimed a couple of days ago, and the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman all but said that he was lying, and this was then widely reported in the Chinese media thereafter. The United States has repeated that claim, and this has also been said by the President of the United States himself following his meeting with Xi Jinping. As I read the Chinese Commerce Ministry's statement, and from what I can tell from the statements of Chinese officials altogether, this is not strictly true. What the Chinese have said is that, yes, they will delay fully enforcing the regulatory regime that they have now set up for exports of rare earths and rare earth-related technologies for a year as part of an extension of the Madrid trade truce, which will now continue for a further year. But this is very conditional on the United States itself continuing the process of rowing back all of the various steps and measures it took over the last few weeks, which have so annoyed China. The United States is expected to take those steps. The Chinese will then reciprocate by taking steps of their own. So, in effect, the Chinese are putting the Americans on a kind of probation. They say, look, we will wait a year before we implement this regulatory regime, but this is very much conditional, contingent on your good behaviour over the course of that year. If we decide that you are going back on what we have agreed today, then there is no reason why we have to wait a year before bringing back all of the restrictions and regulations on the exports of rare earths and attendant technologies that we were talking about and that we set up a week, 2 or 3 weeks ago. So, in a sense, the Chinese are continuing to retain this tool of pressure on the United States and will continue to use it over the course of the next year. Anyway, that in summary, is the agreement that the two governments have made with each other. At the core of the meetings that took place in South Korea was the meeting between President Xi Jinping and President Trump. The meeting lasted 90 minutes. It is almost exactly the same length, by the way, as the meeting between President Trump and President Putin of Russia in Alaska. That too lasted 90 minutes. Each side has provided its account. The President of the United States, as he always does, has been massively overstating the significance of what was achieved. He makes it seem as if some great breakthrough was achieved in the discussions between the United States and China, that the United States has won on every point. Perhaps the only major concession, and I don't even think that from a Chinese point of view, it is an especially big concession, but the Chinese have agreed to buy soybeans from the United States. From China's point of view, I think the importance of this issue has been overstated, but of course it is important for members of the US farming community who have been important parts or vocal parts of President Trump's electoral coalition. But in every other respect, as far as I can see, the Chinese basically have got mostly what they wanted. But of course, President Trump has been saying any more things. He said that the relationship between the United States and China is going to go forward and go from strength to strength, that everything is well, that China has made, basically he's implying significant concessions, that the United States has achieved some big trade victory. Curiously, I've been reading the American and British media, including those parts of the British media that are, relatively sympathetic to Donald Trump. And on this occasion, I noticed that they're not giving him the benefit of the doubt on this. Many of them are themselves signalling that what was agreed with China amounts to significantly less than he is claiming. As for the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, there were some interesting facts about it. Firstly, Trump was his usual effusive, exuberant self. As a Russian commentator that I discussed yesterday has pointed out, Trump can be very manipulative, and that can include appearing to be very charming, and that was what he was yesterday. Xi Jinping was having none of it. He was extremely taciturn throughout all of the public exchanges with Trump. He avoided saying very much at all. The overall impression that I got was that Xi Jinping, in his responses to Trump, was frankly being, if anything, rather stiff. And you could even say that the mood, as far as Xi was concerned, was rather chilly. The Chinese have provided a readout of the meeting, and it is an interesting one. It's long, as Chinese readouts always are, and it contains an awful lot of the kind of philosophical messaging that the Chinese like to engage in, the importance of no win-win cooperation and mutual benefits and that kind of thing. But it contains some interesting phrases, which I'm going to point to. Firstly, it contains these words. President Xi emphasized that there is a good momentum in China's economic development. In the first three quarters of this year, China's economy increased by 5.2%, and import and export trade in goods with the rest of the world expanded by 4%. This is not an easy accomplishment given the domestic and external difficulties. The Chinese economy is like a vast ocean, big, resilient, and promising. We have the confidence and capability to navigate all kinds of risks and challenges. So don't waste your time, in effect, thinking that you can beat us in an economic war. Our economy continues to grow and grow strongly. Despite your trade restrictions, our import and export trade with the rest of the world has continued to expand. If you try to throw troubles, problems, obstacles in our way, well, we will find ways to cope with them, because our economy is like a vast ocean, big, resilient, and promising. We have the confidence and capability to navigate all kinds of risks and challenges, including, by implication, any challenges that you hurl in our direction. And Xi also gave a warning to Trump that the two teams had an in-depth exchange of views on important economic and trade issues and reach consensus on solving various issues. They should work out and finalize the follow-up steps as soon as possible and ensure that the common understandings are effectively upheld and implemented to inject confidence into the two countries as well as the global economy. So, nothing like what happened again, please, after the meeting in Madrid. This time there must be a concrete, positive follow-up. We need to discuss all of these trade issues properly together and work on them together so that they're properly sorted out. There needs to be that trade negotiation which should have started after the Madrid meeting but which never took place. And again, the implication is that if that doesn't happen, China has the ability to go its own way. So there is absolutely here a mailed fist hidden inside the velvet glove. Some of the language might have been polite, though, as I said, my sense of the meeting from the Chinese side is that it was quite chilly. But the Chinese have conceded on no substantive point, except, if you like, soybeans. And they do expect this time that a proper trade agreement will be negotiated and followed through with. And in the meantime, as I said previously, they put the President of the United States and the United States, in effect, it's as well on, if you like, parole for the next year to see how things turn out. Now, there were some further things just to touch on quickly about this meeting. Donald Trump said that the issue of Taiwan was never discussed. To my astonishment, it seems that on this he's right. There is no reference to Taiwan in any part of the Chinese statements. I've been told, in fact, I can confirm that over the last 2 weeks, the Chinese media has been rolling out one exceptionally tough article about Taiwan after another, making it absolutely clear that the issue of Taiwan for China is non-negotiable and a red line. One of these articles spoke about the inevitability of China's reunification, of Taiwan once again being brought back into the Chinese motherland. But President Xi and his officials presumably concluded that if they started bringing up Taiwan over the course of this meeting, the entire meeting might go completely astray. And if were that to happen, the possibility of making any movement, any successful movement on the trade issues, which were the immediate issues on for discussion, might be lost. Now, President Trump claims that he did bring up the question of Ukraine and the war there with President Xi, and that he asked President Xi for help to bring the war to an end, and the President Xi agreed. There is absolutely nothing about that in any Chinese statement. There is no comment to this effect in the Chinese readout of the meeting between President Xi and President Trump. Quite possibly, President Trump did bring this up. I suspect that the Chinese made some non-committal comments, but clearly they're not prepared to take any concrete measures. And President Trump admitted that he did not press the Chinese on China's purchases of Russian oil. Apparently, that question was not pursued by the Americans either. Obviously, because President Trump himself had been advised that bringing up this issue might wreck the discussions about trade. There is no possibility that China will stop buying Russian oil. China buys, as I've since discovered, more Russian oil than India does. And my own view is that whatever brief rearrangements have been made between China and Russia on oil exports to circumvent the latest sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft have probably already been sorted out, and that the full export by Russia of oil to China will continue, and that this will become visible over the next few weeks. On the subject of India, the Indian government, or rather India's big state-owned oil company, the retail seller of Indian oil, has now published a statement saying that India will indeed continue to buy Russian oil. India will do so to the extent that it can, complying with the sanctions. What the Indians are going to try to do, I think it is fairly clear, is that they're going to abide by the letter of the sanctions. In other words, they're not going to have direct dealings with Lukoil or Rosneft, which they scarcely do. They will rely on intermediaries, and the Russian-Indian oil trade, once this process has been sorted out, will continue pretty much as before. On that topic, it has now been confirmed that what is happening in terms of Lukoil's various foreign subsidiaries is that they are being transferred en masse by Lukoil to a Swiss-based company called Govnor, which is a major trader in oil. Govnor has a very long history of working within the Russian oil industry. One of its founders was a Russian businessman, Mr. Timchenko, who was, by the way, sanctioned by the United States. Govnor officially no longer participates in the Russian oil trade anymore. I don't think anybody fully believes that. Undoubtedly, it has all the connections, both in Russia and India, to act as an effective middleman in the Russian-Indian oil trade. And I think that is what we're going to see. The efficient way in which this was done, the transfer of Lukoil assets to Gunvor, and the decisions by the Indian Oil Company. Tell me, by the way, one thing, which is that the Russians have been aware that these sanctions were coming and have been expecting them and have been preparing for them long in advance. Now, on that point, I should acknowledge an email, or rather a set of emails, that I received from my source, who provides me with regular updates of discussions that take place in the Duma, the Russian parliament, and who sent me a succession of emails in March, going all the way back to March of this year. And this person, this source, told me that within Russia itself, it was widely expected that the Trump administration would at some point declare all-out economic war against Russia, would take all kinds of steps to try to suffocate Russia and choke off its energy exports, and that further measures above and beyond that would be taken as well. That the Kremlin was well aware of all of these plans and was actively briefing the Russian parliament about them. That a decision had been made in the Kremlin, in fact, a consensus, a unanimous consensus existed within the Kremlin, that Russia would not bend to this kind of economic coercion by the United States, intended to force Russia to make unacceptable concessions on the conflict in Ukraine, that Russia was confident that it could withstand this economic siege when it came, and that it was already working out and planning its countermeasures, both the measures it would take to prevent this economic siege from destabilizing its domestic economy, but also countermeasures that might hit the United States itself. And I can't help but think that the events of the last 10 days once again vindicate the source that has been providing me with this information. The source has been consistently reliable, and we see again that he is right. And as I said, this very efficient arrangement between Lukoil and Gunvor, which has clearly been worked out, had clearly already been worked out before these sanctions were put into place. Well, that just confirms it. Anyway, on that, and just to wrap up on this issue, I noticed that President Trump made some really, again, rather annoyed comments about Prime Minister Modi whilst he was in South Korea for this meeting with President Xi. He clearly isn't happy about the stance that Prime Minister Modi and India is taking. By the way, the same is true about Modi's feelings and India's feelings about President Trump. The Indians must have noticed this extraordinary contrast in the way in which the United States treats China, which is America's adversary, as opposed to the immense economic pressure the United States over the last few weeks has been exerting against India, which is the United States' friend, just saying. But anyway, the Russians have now also taken a step, which is clearly a negative step with respect to the United States, which is that they've pulled out of an agreement that they had with the United States on disposal of nuclear waste material to prevent that material being used in nuclear weapons and other types of development. The Russians have announced that they'd previously suspended the operation of that agreement. They have now pulled out of it completely, and I expect further steps by the Russians to be taken over the next few weeks. Perhaps, for example, if the United States does, as the Russians expect, which is impose further sanctions, still, the Russians might suspend or stop uranium exports to the United States entirely, as they have threatened to do. Anyway, going back to the meeting between President Xi and President Trump, as I said, no glimmer here in the Chinese readouts of any pressure of China agreeing to anything at all with the United States about Russia. And as a very final observation, I noticed that President Trump, over the course of his various comments, said that he would be visiting China, presumably on President Xi's invitation, in April, and that he expected President Xi to carry out a reciprocal visit to the United States on a later date this year. Now, look at the way the Chinese report this. And this is set out in the readout that the Chinese Foreign Ministry has provided of the discussion between President Trump and President Xi. The two presidents agreed to maintain interactions on a regular basis. President Trump looked forward to visiting China early next year and invited President Xi to visit the United States. That does not say that Xi, that China, invited President Trump to visit China next year. It appears that Trump asked for this invitation and said that he looked forward to visiting China, and then he went out and told the media that he would be visiting China in April and that the Chinese had in fact invited him. This is absolutely typical Trump. He floats a proposal, an idea, and takes the absence of a rejection as a positive acceptance. Now, I ought to say that President Trump has been talking for about 2 weeks about the fact that he was going to meet Xi, President Xi, at the APEC summit. Well, he's been saying this for about 2 weeks. The Chinese only confirmed that Xi would be meeting Trump in South Korea just a few hours before the meeting happened. So the Chinese are being very careful to commit themselves to nothing. Anyway, one very, very final detail. I noticed that the Chinese Commerce Ministry says that there still are unresolved issues over TikTok to discuss. And the United States has been implying that the whole TikTok issue is resolved. Doesn't seem as if the Chinese think so. We will see what happens on that front too. So there we are, a retreat by the United States in its relations with China. My own view is that this difficult period is going to be followed by both sides pressing forward towards a full divorce. I cannot imagine that either the Chinese or the Americans seriously believe that this relationship has a long-term future, at least the relationship as it existed, say, 10 years ago. Each side is going to use the next year perhaps to negotiate with the other, but also to try to develop its alternative economic and technological paths. The Chinese will work to deepen and expand the BRICS and to develop the new payment systems that were discussed last year at the BRICS summit meeting in Kazan in Russia. The Americans are going to wrestle with the technologies of rare earths. Now, I received an email from an investor in a major American company that is working on rare earths. He is confident that the United States will get on top of this technology fairly quickly. I am not, as I've discussed many times, a technological person. I've heard many different views about this, that the Americans will eventually get there. I have no doubt whether they will be able to do that in the kind of time frame that will affect these negotiations. Well, that I cannot predict. We'll just have to wait and see. Anyway, that's the dealings between China and the United States. The relationship between China and Russia in the meantime, as far as I can see, remains intact and continues exactly as before. And over the last few hours, we've had further news from Ukraine. And for Ukraine and for the West, it is catastrophic. Now, the Russians carried out last night another huge combined missile and drone strike against Ukraine. And they are continuing to attack the Ukrainian energy system, the Ukrainian transport infrastructure, the industrial system as well. It was a massive hammer blow. There have been more articles now appearing in the American media especially about the energy crisis that Ukraine is facing over the winter. And there is no suggestion or discussion anywhere anymore about any means on the part of the West to reverse this catastrophic situation that Ukraine is facing in the sky and in terms of its economy, industrial economy, and its energy system. Notice that these attacks now happen on an almost daily level. The scale of these attacks varies. Sometimes they are enormous, and last night's apparently was enormous. Sometimes they're smaller and more precisely targeted. But the cumulative effect of these attacks, night after night, against a Ukraine whose air defense system seems to be essentially now no longer operating, the effect of these attacks looks to be devastating. And I discussed yesterday President Zelensky's claims about drone attacks on Russia. I've discussed how these are pinpricks. The attacks by Russia on Ukraine and by Ukraine on Russia are in no sense analogous in terms of effectiveness and scale, and they should not be compared with each other. However, the situation on the ground has taken over the last 24 hours for Ukraine a further catastrophic turn. Now, like many people who follow this war closely, I continue to receive situation reports from various bloggers and reporting agencies about the situation in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. And it seems to me that in Pokrovsk, the last 24 hours have been particularly catastrophic for the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk itself. Firstly, there is now no doubt that the Russians have captured the railway station, the main railway station in central Pokrovsk, and have advanced north of the railways. They appear to be well inside Pokrovsk, north of the railways. The Ukrainians only have a continuous defense, as far as I can see, in a small part of northeastern Pokrovsk. Most of Pokrovsk is under Russian control. Now, of course, there are Ukrainian stragglers probably in many buildings across Pokrovsk. There's probably small holdouts of Ukrainian troops in various districts and neighborhoods. No doubt the Russian army is busy mopping all of these people up, flushing them out. And there are reports that in the southern edge of the Pokrovsk cauldron, the Russians have established a cauldron inside the cauldron of a Ukrainian brigade, the very same brigade that had previously been trying a few weeks ago to break through to Novoekonomichnye, and which now itself is deeply trapped. It seems to me that the territory in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd that the Ukrainians control has now shrunk, perhaps over the last 24 hours, by something like 10 to 20%. This is my own very rough calculation based on what the mapping projects say. Of course, I might be wrong, but that seems to me the general position. Anyway, that is not the worst part of the news, because it seems that having consolidated their control of Rodinska, north of Pokrovsk, the Russian army has pushed south and west from Rodinska. The famous crossroads where the Ukrainian supply convoys had been trying to enter Pokrovsk, only to be destroyed by the Russian drones, with the video footage of the crossroads littered with the burnt out skeletons of Ukrainian supply vehicles. The crossroads have apparently now been captured by the Russians, at least that's what some reports say, and the Russians have pushed south beyond the crossroads. The Russians also have taken positions in northeast Pokrovsk. I said that the Ukrainians still have a continuous positions in northeast Pokrovsk, but the Russians are there too. And it's been said that the distance between the Russian advance positions south of the crossroads and the Russian forces in northeast Pokrovsk has reduced to just a kilometer, which is an impossibly short funnel for Ukrainian troops to retreat from. And, well, the Russians have released a picture of their flag appearing at the entrance, the formal entrance of Pokrovsk, whereas it's often the case with cities in Ukraine, the big poster appears of Pokrovsk telling you that you're about to enter the city. The Russians yesterday put up their flag there. The Ukrainians conducted a drone attack to destroy the flag. But it seems that the Russians are indeed in control of this territory and that they are advancing north of it as well. So the cauldron is being further sealed. It's entirely possible that at some point within the next day, the Russian forces in the north will meet up with the Russian forces in the south, and then we will have a continuous ring of Russian troops encircling the Ukrainians inside Pokrovsk, something that we have not seen in this way since the Battle of Mariupol in the summer of 2022. Now, this is utterly catastrophic. There appears to be a degree of dissension about what to do in Kiev itself. There are reports that President Zelensky has ordered General Sirsky, the Ukrainian commander-in-chief, to assemble reinforcements, to concentrate them at the village of Gryshino, which the Ukrainians still control, and to conduct attacks to break the ring, the Russian ring, around the Ukrainian troops in Pokrovsk. There are also reports that General Sirsky is rejecting these orders. Supposedly, there simply aren't enough forces. Ukraine no longer has enough forces to carry out that sort of attack. Now, if this is true, then this is the first time that I know of when Sirsky has resisted an order to attack made to him by President Zelensky. And if that is correct, then it gives us an idea of how bad the situation has become. Now, it must be said that this information is not confirmed, and it does appear that Sirsky is indeed in the area. There were reports this morning that he had arrived in the general area of Pokrovsk and was trying to work out what, if anything, could be done. But there is one thing which suggests that there is indeed some sort of argument going on between Sirsky and Zelensky as well. And this is that as at the time of making of this program, Sirsky has been silent, I think I'm right in saying, for some 5 days. He has made no public statements, at least not on his Telegram channel, that I'm aware of, or at least his public channels that I'm aware of. At least I haven't seen them. And that does suggest that he's severely embarrassed about the situation in Pokrovsk and perhaps in conflict over what to do with Zelensky. I have also seen that there is now reports that a Ukrainian brigade commander in the Pokrovsk area is about to be cashiered on the grounds that he apparently deceived the Ukrainian command about the catastrophic state of the situation in Pokrovsk. I've already said many times that, in my opinion, this is unworthy of Sirsky. He, as the overall commander, ought to be taking responsibility. And it could also be that this silence from Sirsky is a sign that he is in disfavour, which might, of course, have some effect on his long-term prospects. Though I'm not going to explore that on this programme. Now, there's been less news about the situation in Kupiansk over the last 24 hours, but I understand that the situation there for the Ukrainian troops is at least as bad as in Pokrovsk, perhaps worse. But anyway, certainly there is no sign that things there for the Ukrainians are getting any better. And I discussed the situation in Konstantinovka and Lehman in my program yesterday. There are now, well, not just reports, but video footage showing the Russians advancing, capturing territory immediately to the south of Siversk, this fortified town that the Ukrainians have held since the start of the war, which is now effectively surrounded on all sides by Russian territory. The Russians are now capturing the remaining villages south and, of course, south of Siversk. They already control the villages to the north and east. Everything points to another assault on Siversk by the Russians simultaneously from multiple directions, even as the supply roads to Siversk are cut. I cannot imagine that there is any prospect for the Ukrainian garrison in Siversk being able to withstand these attacks when they come for very long. My guess is that we're going to see a sudden and dramatic collapse in Siversk, very similar to the one that we saw in Ugledar a year ago. And, well, the Russians, according to the Russian Defense Ministry, now control the entire west bank of the Yanchur River in Zaporozhye region, and they continue to push forward, gradually encircling the important nearby town of Gulyapolye. Anyway, a crisis in the sky, a crisis on land. There are still some people in the West who deny this. President Putin of Russia yesterday made a proposal for a brief ceasefire in the Pokrovsk and Kupiansk area to allow journalists, especially Western journalists, to actually go and even enter the cauldrons and to find out and to see for themselves what was really happening there. Who was actually telling the truth about the military situation in Kupiansk and Pokrovsk, and who was not? Putin spoke with extraordinary appearance of confidence that he is the person with the correct information. And about that, by the way, I have no doubt at all that he is right. There's been no acknowledgement, as far as I know, of this offer by President Zelensky. And if we're talking about the West, well, here in Britain, there's been barely any coverage of this offer by Putin at all. It's as if nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to go to find out what the true situation on the battlefronts is. They've been given an offer to see whether there is indeed an encirclement in Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. But nobody wants to face to the truth. Now, there has been an extraordinarily bleak assessment of the state of the war from a most unexpected source. And this is the foreign news editor of the Times, Roger Boyce. I believe he's the editor. At any rate, he is the Times, the London Times' most famous and respected foreign correspondent. I mean, he's been working for them for as long as I can remember. And he is also somebody who is widely assumed in Britain to be extremely well informed and briefed by the British government. And he has published an article which is attracting a lot of attention. He says, I hate to say it, but Kiev won't last till spring. For all the EU's rousing words, there just isn't the money or the will to keep defending Ukraine. And he describes the situation unusually to an extent that with an accuracy that I barely ever see coming from him or from Western journalists in the war. He talks about how the sanctions, the new US sanctions, disrupt an important source of Moscow's export revenue, but won't stop it creating new layers of shell companies. The sanctions news actually raised oil prices. He then says that this winter we'll see a more concentrated Russian assault on Ukraine's so-called fortress belt on its eastern front. The line of cities, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, Pokrovsk. If these defensive lines start to fall, then the way would be clear for Russian troops to move into central Ukraine. Well, you've been hearing that very thing on these programs day after day, week after week, month after month, in fact, over some years. Moscow's mobilization target for 2025 allows for 350,000 soldiers signed up on time-limited contracts. Many of them are in training. The plan seems to be to open up the east. He talks about the situation in Pokrovsk, and he then speaks about the Russians breaking through and then preparing for a surge into the Ukrainian heartland in the spring. And then he goes on to say the Russian military is walking in step with the Kremlin's assessment of how long it will take before Kiev's finances start to fold. And in fact, reports in the Western media basically acknowledge that Ukraine is going to run out of money around March, April. The 140 billion euro loan drawn on the Russian funds, supposedly, is the last throw. Probably that won't last very long, if it's ever provided. And for the moment, at least, doubts about it appear, if anything, to be growing. And he then says that if some way were to be found to transfer the whole sum, this big loan to Ukraine, it could continue to fight and stay alive. The cash transfer, however, would almost certainly be seen as illegal by the Kremlin and challenged in the courts. And that, of course, doesn't just mean the European courts, it means courts around the world. And he seems to be very pessimistic about the prospects, ultimately, of significant financing being provided to Ukraine. And he makes it also clear that there is really no prospect of European governments being able to find funds for Ukraine from other sources, from their own budgets. And there isn't much in the way of further funding coming from the United States. And he speaks about this winter being basically Zelensky's last stand. It might turn out to be the last 150 days of war, and that it's far from clear, and he apparently doesn't believe that Ukraine is going to be able to hold out beyond the spring. Well, that's Roger Boyce, as I said, very well-informed British journalist, a fervid supporter of Ukraine throughout the war. An earlier article of earlier articles from him have talked up Ukraine's prospects. Here we see, and I suspect he's obtaining this information from inside the British government, that the realities, the true realities in Ukraine are beginning to be acknowledged and are starting to break through. And again, I can't help but think that this is another article intended to prepare the British public for the collapse which is about to come. Notice, however, again, the obvious, glaring, colossal gap in Roger Boyce's article, because he appears to acknowledge that Ukraine is going to be defeated. He expects this to happen as soon as the spring. If you read his article carefully, he seems fully aware of the catastrophic results of such a defeat, certainly for Ukraine, perhaps for the West, but nowhere, in no place, even as he makes clear his doubts that there's anything militarily that can be done now to change the outcome, nowhere does he suggest a diplomatic outreach to the Russians by the Ukrainians, the Americans, the Europeans, or the British to see whether it might be possible to find some other way, some other resolution that might avoid the ultimate catastrophe and perhaps preserve Ukraine. In Britain, the only person who has any authority, carries any weight in establishment circles, who does this on a regular basis, that I'm aware of, is Lord Robert Skidelsky. He's done this repeatedly in courageous, I would say heroic, comments that he has made in the House of Lords, asking pertinent, tough questions of government ministers, exploring options for diplomatic outreach and possible compromise. And every one of his observations and comments from official circles, from the British government, has been heard, as far as I can tell, in stony silence. And Roger Boyce, who I personally would classify absolutely as a person from within the British establishment, even as he looks defeat, disaster in the face, disaster for Ukraine, disaster for the West, disaster for Britain, he has nothing of that nature to offer at all. It is as if this he's up against an implacable enemy, which is to say Russia, determined to exact its price, and that's all there is to say. There is nothing else, no suggestion that the Russians, despite the reality that they have made endless numbers of attempts going all the way back to the 2014 crisis to find some diplomatic way out, there's no suggestion that any of that has happened, no acknowledgement that it has happened, and no suggestion that perhaps the time has come to pick up the telephone, talk to Moscow, see whether they will accept maybe an EU or a British representative, and whether some kind of serious negotiation can take place. To the extent that there are any proposals at all from the West and from the Ukrainians, they appeared at the moment to be coming from President Zelensky. About 2 weeks ago, there were reports that the Europeans and the Ukrainians, in response to Donald Trump's proposal for a summit meeting with President Putin in Budapest, that the Europeans were coming up with a 12-point, was it 10-point peace plan of their own. Well, President Zelensky has now outlined it. It makes no substantive shift from previous Ukrainian diplomatic positions that the West, that the Europeans and the British have supported. Well, of course, to correct that, the Ukrainians did agree in March of this year that they would accept a freeze of the conflict on the existing battle lines, but absolutely not a final resolution of the conflict, one which would oblige them to recognise territories in eastern Ukraine currently occupied by the Russians as Russian. Anyway, that has been the only substantive concession, if it even is a concession, which Zelensky has made. He has made absolutely no others. And, well, in the latest plan, there is some discussion about the Russians and the Ukrainians making concessions to each other on linguistic and human rights. But it's all incredibly vague. I don't believe for a moment that it is intended sincerely. And notice that the fact that Zelensky is linking Ukrainian actions in terms of linguistic and human rights to Russian ones is in effect telling the Russians, well, I'm not going to really agree to anything, because what I'm going to do is make demands of you which you will never meet, which you will never meet and can never meet. So that tells us that the diplomatic dead end continues to be there. And for the moment at least, President Trump has completely thrown away his plans to try and find some kind of compromise with the Russians. He's been trying instead to put pressure on them to accept General Kellogg's freeze idea. The Russians are not going to bend to that, and that there is no prospect at all of them doing so. And of course, if Roger Boys is right, and that the war could end in a Ukrainian collapse in 150 days, and I'm not, by the way, saying that I necessarily endorse that timetable. Anyway, if Roger Boys is right, well, 150 days doesn't give even Donald Trump much room, much time in which to adjust or rethink his position. It could be that by the time he realizes that the Russians are going to win the war and that their economy isn't going to collapse and that the Chinese are not going to turn on them and that the Indians are not going to abandon them and that BRICS is going to continue, it could be that by that point, by the point President Trump realizes all of these things, it will be too late. Anyway, on that topic, let's turn quickly to relations between Russia and the United States, because the Russians, President Putin, have now unveiled yet another terrifying weapon, which is the Poseidon submarine drone. Now, the Burevestnik cruise missile, which I discussed extensively in recent programs, has been known about since 2018, but there were serious doubts whether the Russians would ever be able to put it into actual production. Many people suspected that this was an entirely unreal project, more a propaganda exercise than an actual one. But it does now look as if all of those claims were wrong, that the Russians are producing hardware, an actual nuclear-powered cruise missile, of which no analogue exists anywhere else in the world. Well, Putin has now confirmed that the Poseidon submarine drone has for the first time been tested through launch from a nuclear submarine. And almost certainly, by the way, the nuclear submarine is the Belgorod, the world's biggest submarine, which has been converted into a launcher for these Poseidon nuclear-powered submarine drones. And, well, that tells us that the Poseidon submarine is Poseidon torpedo, nuclear-powered torpedo or drone, is now indeed in service. Now, again, this is a terrifying weapon, and Putin has provided us with further information about it. He has confirmed that it carries a very, very large and powerful nuclear warhead. There has been speculation that this warhead is in the megaton range. Some people believe that it is even more powerful than the Tsar Bomba, the 54 megaton device that the Soviet Union tested all the way back in the early 1960s. Well, I'm not going to speculate about that because I don't know. But Putin again says that this is undetectable, that it can operate under the world ocean, that with a nuclear reactor, it has effectively unlimited range. He appears to confirm that it too is designed to loiter for long periods. And in other words, that the Russians could launch it during a time of crisis and it could take up patrol positions and presumably it would receive signals in some way from Moscow. And when those signals were sent, well, it would either strike the United States or be recalled. I'm not going to get into further speculations. And Putin also appeared to confirm some of the rumours that have been circulating for many years, that it is intended to create a gigantic wave, a tsunami perhaps, a massive tsunami effect, so that coastal cities in Europe and the United States would be drowned in a massive flood of water, seawater, which would be affected by radiation. And well, I'm not going to discuss further the catastrophic implications of all of this. Putin did have some other interesting things to say about the nuclear reactors that these two weapons, the Burevestnik and the Poseidon, each have. And from what he said, it seems that the Burevestnik's reactor is more advanced. He said that relative to size, it is more than 1,000 times more powerful than a conventional nuclear reactor. The Poseidon Poseidon's reactor is 100 times more powerful. So it's a very advanced reactor, but it works at perhaps some sort of lower level than the Burevestnik one does. It seems that the Norwegians have said that when they monitored the Burevestnik test, that there was no discharge of radioactive elements, no contamination, no radioactive contamination. So all the speculations and discussions that are all over the internet, which compare the Burevestnik to the American Pluto project of the 1950s and 60s, which did discharge radiation, are obviously wrong. That was a much more basic, cruder system, if you will, using far less advanced technologies than the Burevestnik and the Poseidon do. I am not a technical person and I'm not going to speculate further about the nature of these technologies. But to me, it does look, as I've said previously, as a very important technological breakthrough. And Putin is now saying that this technology does indeed have civilian uses. It could be used in the space industry. I am guessing it could be used to provide AI equipment with enormous levels of power. In fact, it seems to me that the combination of this nuclear technology, which I believe only the Russians possess, and AI is obvious. But anyway, I'm not going to discuss this further today. But anyway, these enormously powerful, very frightening, very destabilizing weapons now exist. Now, the obvious response to these developments in the United States, and bear in mind that they have been aware that the Russians have been working on these programs since at least 2018, when Putin announced them publicly. The response from the United States is not, as I would have suggested, to meet with the Russians, conduct negotiations, extend the START treaty, see whether perhaps the Russians can be persuaded to do away with these weapons. It has been instead, well, according to President Trump, to resume nuclear testing. To my mind, this is absurd. It is a march of folly. What can nuclear testing achieve which goes beyond what we have seen? Bear in mind, the Russians have achieved this technological breakthrough without having to resort to nuclear testing. Nuclear testing goes against all kinds of agreements. It further undermines the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is on life support already. Bear in mind that civilian nuclear facilities were attacked in Iran in June of this year, in apparent violation of that, well, in definite violation of that treaty. I don't see how any of this assists the United States to address the challenges that these weapons represent. It seems to me that the United States instead, at least the president, are looking again for some way to equalize these deployments by the Russians. And, well, that further leads to the collapse of the system of arms control negotiated between the Soviet and American superpowers during the Cold War, starting with the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. And, well, in a world where there are no limits on such testing or on the deployment of such weapons, where there are now at least two powerful alternative nuclear powers, China, which will soon catch up with Russia and the United States and can probably in time surpass both of them, and North Korea as well, which is not to be discounted. Well, it seems to me that throwing away any remaining provision for nuclear arms control is an incredible folly. But that, it seems, is where we're going as relations between Moscow and Washington continue in extreme deep freeze. Well, this is all I'm going to say in this program today about this topic. I'm sure I'm going to return to it many, many times. It seems to me definitely that whatever prospects for a detente between America and Russia existed this year have now probably decisively thrown away. But anyway, we will see. Perhaps next year will promise something better, but I can't imagine they will promise anything good for Ukraine. Anyway, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar. Don't forget to go to our new Substack page. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Thank you again. More from me soon. Have a very good day.